Lompoa, when I'm back at Amaravati, I will be involved in training the Anagarikas, and I'm only 7 vasas. I would like to ask for advice, whatever you can give me.
Well, you're senior enough to be able to have a direct experience and just trust your awareness. I mean, the thing with taking on duties is that, you know, how do you hold this sense of I'm responsible for training Anagarikas, and that can be, you know, you can be a kind of perfectionist. You've got all kinds of ideals and ideas and concepts about training and how it should be. And then there's the realities of dealing with actual living human beings who coming from a lay life into a samana life. So mainly trust your awareness, your mindfulness. Like the training, and be aware of how it affects you, like just the concept of being in charge, of having to train, how these kind of thoughts, these kind of concepts, how they affect your emotions, so that you can use a situation, you know, with wisdom to, you know, to see how we hold positions or status or see ourselves in relationship to others, whether we're junior, senior, monk, nun, whatever. We all need to do this to see, you know, not just operate from a standard of principles and ideals, but also bring in the reality of human existence is an ideal. You know, you'll never set up an ideal woman's community or a man's community. You know, the ideal is, you know, this is really important, because idealism, especially in Western consciousness, is, you know, like American culture is based on ideals, not on Dhamma, on way things are, but on how things should be. And so, you know, on the intellectual level, we all know how an ideal monastery should be. So we can create in our minds an ideal monastery, an ideal monastics, and then the realities of the actual living experience is not about ideals. It's not about what should be, but it's the way it is. So this reflection on the way it is intuitive. It's intuitive, it's not intellectual. Your intellectual one will create an ideal and an aspiration to try hard and do your best and live up to, you know, a high standard of principles and so forth. That's the ideal. But so, you know, I always consider the ideal, the intellect, is the brain. You know, that's the discriminatory function that we're living with, is the thinking mind. It's based on dualism, on, you know, right and wrong, good and bad, heaven and hell. And then in mindfulness or awareness, it's the intuition, which is heartfelt. It's how, you know, it's not about judgment or you know, setting up, passing judgment on yourself or others, but observing what you're actually feeling. And as you open to the Anagarikas you're training, you know, you can also trust your intuition. you have your ideals are like guiding stars, you know, they're high up. But in the reality of daily life, it's intuitive awareness that we need to respect. So like the Dhamma, we use this word in this tradition, the Dhamma, and we think, what is the Dhamma, you know? As someone that comes from a non-Buddhist background, you know, you chant, I take refuge in the Dhamma, and then you think it's some kind of mystical energy in the universe, or we tend to create abstract ideas or kind of metaphysical abstractions about the Dhamma. But the Dhamma is apparent here and now. It's not highly metaphysical and something way up that you will eventually understand. So if I ask you right now, if I asked you, are you conscious? You say yes, wouldn't you? And so consciousness or mindfulness or awareness, I use these three terms interchangeably. Then, you know, Dhamma is here and now, so it's awareness, it's mindfulness, it's consciousness. Because wherever you go, you know, whether you're here or alone in your kuti or in England, or you're conscious, whether you're sitting, standing, walking, lying down. Consciousness doesn't cease even when you're sleeping. You know, so this is why consciousness and Dhamma are really the refuge, or awareness is the path to the deathless. So this is what you instruct yourself, you know, to keep reminding yourself, because you're conditioned to think you are a physical body, you are a personality, you are a woman, you are a nun. You know, we identify with the things that change and are impermanent. Like the physical body is impermanent, and yet that's the strongest identity that human beings have, is I'm this physical form here. But when you investigate the body with awareness, not from any position of positive or negative position, but just beginning to intuitively aware of the physical body, you know, you might have the conception or perceive that awareness is inside the body, or consciousness is inside your body. So that would make consciousness separate, you know, like your consciousness is over there, my consciousness is here. So when you see consciousness as inside a physical body, that's not the way it is. Because consciousness has no boundary. It's one of the immeasurables. It has no limitation. Where does consciousness begin or end? Where you're, instead of seeing consciousness as inside your body, see your, you know, instruct yourself or question yourself, is the body and consciousness. So at this time, you know, in this meeting here, just to reflect on the fact that consciousness is unitive. It's the same for all of us. It's not bhikkhu, siladhara, meji, lay people, or personal. And so it's, you know, it's consciousness has no boundary. It has no birth or death. Where the body has boundaries, it has a shape, you know. So it was born, grows up, gets old, and dies. That's the nature of the body. you're aware of the body. So that's awareness of the body. Is you know, encouraged to investigate, to see that the body is something that you're aware of as an object. You're aware that you're sitting, you're aware that you're breathing, inhaling, exhaling, you're aware that you're seeing. You can see, hear, smell, taste, touch, think. You're aware of all these functions. So awareness, you know, this, or mindfulness, or consciousness, is unitive. It's universal. It's not personal. So you can't say that I'm more conscious than you are. I can say that, but it's not true. And the society, you know, most people, even in Thailand, which is a Buddhist country, see that consciousness is inside them. You know, as some kind of, when you die, your consciousness, when your body dies, your consciousness dies, and consciousness is seen as personal, like a soul or a spirit. But consciousness is the knowing of the here and now. So like you have santitiko dhamma, the qualities of dhamma when we chant santitiko, akaliko, ehipasiko, opanayiko, bhajjatangve tidapawenu, and these are Pali words. The English translation, santitiko is apparent here and now. And ask yourself, you know, each one of you, what's apparent here and now that is obvious? Like when I ask you, are you conscious? Every one of you will say yes. It's apparent. If I ask you to show me consciousness, show me that you're conscious. You can't. You can't objectify it. You can't take it and see it yourself. You know, it's not something that comes and goes and that you can see, hear, smell, taste, touch, or think and get some kind of form or quality to it. But it's here and now. It's timeless. Akalika Dhamma, akaliko, timelessness. Try to intellectualize timelessness. Think about timelessness. And, you know, this is like to experiment with your intellect. Can you really conceive and describe santitiko, akaliko, timeless? You know, because the very thinking process that we identify with, that we create ourselves, our souls, our personalities with our thoughts and memories, these are all sankharas. These are all conditioned phenomena. And so, you know, to realize the Dhamma, to know Dhamma, you can't use sankharas. You know, one sankhara can't know another sankhara. So on the intellectual level, you talk about Nibbana and enlightenment, all these high-fluting words that we use, but you can't conceive it. You know, you can fantasize about enlightenment or nibbana, but you don't really know what it is. You know, so you make it sound it's the highest happiness, or it's absolute peace, or it's the deathless. So words that we use to try to convey a meaning to what we're engaged in is summon us as meditators. But it's the mindfulness, the intuitive awareness that we begin to trust. Because intuition isn't a sankhara. You know, it's awareness, it's consciousness, awareness here and now. It's not something that begins and ends, but something we can easily overlook. and not give importance to. So this time, you know, in, it seems like the Western world has kind of opened up to mindfulness. In England, for example, they have courses on mindfulness. You get YouTube mindfulness programs, apps, and so forth. You know, 50 years ago, nobody's interested in mindfulness. Nobody understood it. And you can see modern science and psychology are trying to understand consciousness. You know, is it the brain? Is it, you know, they want to define it. They want to conceive consciousness and know consciousness as something that you can describe with words, and that you can, you know, that you can objectify, but you can't objectify consciousness, because that's what you are. You know, that's your true identity. You know, when you ask, if you wonder, who am I? You know, and think, am I this physical body? And that's what it seems like, you know, in daily life. It seems, especially when you're old, your physical body is packing up, and it does seem very personal. And but when you reflect on it, and you see the body's in consciousness isn't born and doesn't die, doesn't begin or end. And so you begin to use intuition, awareness, mindfulness, or the word apperception, ability to, you know, it's not to apperceive is like to perceive is focus on an object. To apperceive is to embrace the moment here and now. So encouraging you to, this is like investigating Dhamma, the way it is. You know, so what I'm saying here, just don't quote me on it and believe what I say, but the emphasis is to encourage you to investigate, to trust your awareness, to investigate, because the teachings of the Buddha are all pointers, they're directional signs, they're not dogmatic. You know, they're not metaphysical teachings about ultimate reality. They're not, you know, they're not philosophical. They're pointing to the here and now, santitiko, apparent here and now, akaliko, timeless. Ahipasiko is translated to come and see. It's like an invitation to come and look right now. Wake up. This is consciousness that you're experiencing. You don't have to go looking for it, but because you're looking for something that's not you, some idea or some ideal or some definition you've read in a dictionary about consciousness. But you don't need to find it or describe it, but recognize it. It's this knowing here and now. So consciousness knows. It's not it's the knowing of the present moment of experience at this moment. It's knowing. It's like this. So we use this word, these words in English, it's like this, is a skillful use of words, which are sankharas. So it's not telling you what it's like. It's not saying it's good, bad, right or wrong, big or small. But using this refrain, it's like this, is a way of kind of stopping trying to search and find and conceive and believe or deny, to be the awareness of what's happening. what you're thinking, what you're feeling in the present reality of experience here and now. Ehi Pasiko is come and see, and then Opanayiko is leading inwards. You notice, like, when we identify consciousness with senses, sense consciousness, then we're conscious through senses, through seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, thinking, perceiving and sensation. And so the ignorance that we bind ourselves to is the ignorance of always seeing everything in this separative form of I'm the subject, this person here is the subject, you're the object, what I see is the object, what I smell is the object, what I hear is the object of the ear and smell of the nose and taste of the tongue. So there's always this sense of going out, sending consciousness out to objects, through seeing, through hearing, through smelling, through tasting, touching, through thinking, through feeling. So consciousness, is when we send it out all the time, where it's still consciousness, but it's fixed on objects that we like or don't like, that we approve of or don't approve of. So the critical mind is the, what divides and creates divisions in ourselves, in our lives, in the world at large. Because it's thinking that is about right and wrong, good and bad, big and small, male and female. It's the identities that we hold, that I'm, my reality is Ajahn Sumedho, or my nationality, or my gender is my identity. But in terms of Dhamma, these are all sankharas. So in terms of the five khandhas in the Pali tradition, of vipassana meditation, you have rupa, which is the body, vedana is the feeling, sanya is the memory, sankhara is the emotion, the feeling, emotional feeling, habits, vijnana is consciousness. So in the reciting the five khandhas, they're all impermanent. Like sense consciousness is impermanent, so you can only look at something and for a period of time it begins and ends. Seeing begins and ends. Hearing begins and ends, and so forth. So that all sankharas are impermanent. And this in vipassana meditation is this investigation, like sape sankharani cha, all conditions are impermanent. Now this is not a doctrine. This is, some people say you have to be a Buddhist, you have to believe all conditions are impermanent. That's not a skillful use of the teaching. Because you don't have to believe that, you investigate it. Just observe how what you see, hear, smell, taste, touch, think, feel, pleasure, pain, neutral feeling, memories come and go. What is the future right now? What is tomorrow? It's imagination, isn't it? You're not aware of the future. You're not aware of the past. You're aware of memories of the past, of yesterday. You're aware of your plans or ideas of what you're going to do tomorrow, what's going to happen tomorrow. But it's always here and now. Santitiko akaliko dhamma. Ehi pasko, come and see. Opanayaka, leading here, to intuitive awareness rather than seeking enlightenment, nirvana, or heaven, or whatever, is something external that you conceive through the thought process or through that you can actually visualize or hear or smell or taste or touch. So, like in the Four Noble Truths, this is a teaching, the Buddha's first sermon after his enlightenment. And the Buddha, you know, in the scriptures, this is in the suttas, when after he was enlightened, the first thought was, how can you explain Dhamma? How can you teach Dhamma? There's no words. It's beyond words. You know, so you have the idea that you teach through language, through concepts, through doctrines, through perceptions, you know, seemed impossible because it isn't something you perceive or conceive. So how can you teach it? So then the thought came, you know, it's kind of pointless to even try to teach anyone else. And then according to the scripture, the Brahma Sahampati, the sky god, came to the Buddha and said, there are those with only a little dust in their eyes, and go out and teach for the welfare of those. So all of you have little dust in your eyes. And then this is, you know, this sense that why do you come to what Nanachat? You know, is it, you know, it's disciplined, it has a schedule, you have to conform to a whole set of rules and ideas of monastic life. And if you're from abroad, you know, living in a strange, different environment, why do you come here and shave your heads or bear with the discipline, the schedule of a monastic life? Because there's in you a kind of wakeness, a sense of there's something more to life than just happiness, sensual happiness, success, power, and that the worldly mind, you know, seeks fulfillment through objects, through wealth, through power, through success. But every human being has this potential. You know, it's the same consciousness, so it's not like, you know, you can't feel superior to others because the consciousness is unitive. It's one consciousness. They're not two consciousnesses. When I talk about sending consciousness out, it's the same consciousness, but you're using it through the senses, through this sensual experience of your body. So, you know, so that's very dependent, like my vision is degenerating. So, you know, seeing consciousness is not very accurate. So if I depended on seeing, there would be, you know, old age would be suffering. You know, if my whole sense of reality and being alive was being able to see clearly or hear clearly, I'm wearing hearing aids. I can't walk very well. So, you know, in terms of taking all these personally, if I'm just the sense organs of the body, they're bound to disappoint you. You know, because they are imperfect. They're sankharas. They're born, they die, they begin and end, they develop, they degenerate. And that's the nature of sankharas. So like to know sankharas, and I repeat again, a sankhara can't know a sankhara. You know, it's impossible for even the best of sankharas to know a sankhara. So what is it that knows sankharas is awareness, consciousness. Consciousness that is not just fixating on objects of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, thinking. You know, so like in meditation, you're withdrawing your interest in what you see, hear, smell, taste, touch, think, to awareness, mindfulness, samadhi, concentration. So that's like upanayaka dhamma, leading inwards, or here and now, to the here and now. And then bhajjatang vaiti dapo vinyu is the last reflection on dhamma, which is to be experienced individually by the wise. So this is a wisdom, and this intuitive awareness is the development of wisdom, is using wisdom in your life rather than just ideas and operating from habit patterns that you've acquired in your life, just thinking habits, emotional habits that tend to, you know, get strongly identified with them. And I've seen in my own life, you know, how conditioned I, you know, on one level, my thinking mind is, my emotional habits are, you know, developed as a child, as a teenager. And, you know, when you're 85 years old and your emotions are still like a teenager, it's rather discouraging. Tell people, when I was in the Peace Corps in the 1960s, I had my 30th birthday in Sabah, in North Borneo, and I thought, I'm 30 years old now, and in 30 more years I'll be 60, and I thought, these 30 years that I've lived, you know, I had great hopes for wisdom and understanding when I was 20. By the time I was 30, I was disillusioned. I hadn't reached anything that I could consider wise or, you know, a great improvement. I acquired a lot of experience during that decade, but not all of it was very good. And I thought, if I have to spend 30 more years, because then when you're 30, 60 seems very old. Now it doesn't seem very old. So I thought, what am I going to do after, you know, the next 30 years? Am I just going to reinforce old habits, operate from the same emotional habits I've developed in my life, or think the same old thoughts, and just spend my life acquiring more knowledge about objects, intellectual objects, or seeking distraction endlessly from the here and now? So this is what leads to an interest in monasticism. You know, I was a Buddhist at the time, so I had read a lot of books mainly on Zen Buddhism. And so I had, you know, but living in Southeast Asia, I thought Thailand would be the best place to come after the Peace Corps, because it was close, you know, Malaysia, and Thailand was a Buddhist country I didn't know anything about. So Thailand seemed the logical. I mean, I thought of Japan because I thought, you know, I was interested in Zen Buddhism. I didn't know very much heard anything about Theravada. But then I remembered in the Navy, I was in the Navy, those cold winters in Japan. And I heard they didn't heat their monasteries. And then going on holidays to Thailand, I thought, it was a nice warm country. So out of, not out of particular choice of Theravada over Zen, just out of a kind of cowardice and preference for warmth, I chose Thailand. And of course it turned out very well, meeting such a great teacher as Lumpho Cha. I didn't know anyone in Thailand when I came, you know. I was given the address by a hippie when I was in Borneo of Wat Maha Thot in Bangkok. There's a meditation teacher there. So that's where I started. But this is the question and answer period, so I hope I've helped you in your... Any more questions?
What is dukkha? And what's the end of dukkha?
Well, dukkha is translated as suffering. And all sankharas are dukkha because they arise and cease. So it's just a word that the Buddha, you know, like the First Noble Truth is a statement. It's an ordinary experience. You know, it's the most banal, most ordinary human experience that we all can relate to. You don't have to look outside to see it. You know, you begin to see, you know, the idea of looking inward rather than outward. You can see a lot of suffering out in the world. You hear about all kinds of, you know, horrible things happening in the news. But that's not the noble truth that the Buddha is using, is the dukkha, the suffering we create through thinking. You know, wanting something we don't have. Not wanting things to be the way they are. Sensual desire, you know, wanting, you know, just to have pleasurable sense experiences is dukkha. So, you know, when Amaravati, I used to address the retreats was saying, you, all of you are here because you think that you're not good enough the way you are, that you've come to a monastery to get something, to become enlightened, like you're not enlightened, you're not good enough the way you are, and you want to get something called enlightenment, make you better than the way you think you are now. So this is just a reflection on dukkha, how we create the sense of I'm missing something, I lack something, I'm not good enough the way I am. Or we can take the power of positive thinking, saying I'm perfect, I'm just perfect the way I am, which is the form of conceit. That's still dukkha. So you can't conceive yourself. And this is why it's a noble truth, because it pertains to all of us. Easy to see, it's ordinary. The devas have dukkha. The devils have a lot of dukkha. The rich, the most rich, the king, the queen, Queen Elizabeth has a lot of dukkha. And because she doesn't like the way things are. And many of us who live in Britain have dukkha because we don't want Britain to leave the European Union. You know, we don't want the way it is. But you can observe that. You know, if I grasp my own personal preferences and opinions, that's one thing. You know, out of ignorance, I just operate from conceits, from views, opinions, prejudices, fear. You know, you're self-conscious, worried about what others think of you, worrying about the future, what am I going to do? Remorse, the guilt about past experiences, past things you've done or said, all arise in the present moment. So dukkha is, you know, there's different translations of dukkha, but they all mean suffering or stress or unsatisfactoriness. And we think, you know, nobody wants dukkha. This is the interesting point about Buddhism, Buddha Dhamma, is that most religions start from the top, you know, like, I believe in God. That's high up. And like I said, what is God? Where is God? Show me God. What is it? And nobody can show you. You know, nobody knows themselves, but they believe. But dukkha, when the Buddha was enlightened, he taught there is suffering. Two of these five colleagues of his who deserted him, because, you know, they'd attained all kinds of powers and psychic powers and levels of samadhi, concentration. They developed all the condition realm to perfection. But they still doubted. They still suffered. So dukkha is to be understood, it's not to be rejected. Like nobody wants dukkha. And I would ask myself, why did the Buddha choose something nobody wants as a noble truth? Why not love? Universal love, that's inspiring. When you talk about unconditioned universal love as a noble truth, that inspires the mind. And so inspiration comes from that kind of teaching, where it's not that it's wrong, it's reality. All is love. It's ultimate reality. But you can't really understand that. You know, you can idealize it, and we long for it, and we want to get rid of dukkha. So we suppress suffering. And instead of getting rid of dukkha, you understand it. And to understand dukkha is not to grasp it, but to accept it. It's like this. Wanting something you don't have is like this. Wanting something you have you don't want is like this. Sensual desire through the senses is wanting, you know, to have some kind of success or happiness or sensual pleasure is desire. Desire and dukkha are the same thing. So the second noble truth is about desire, the cause of suffering. So you investigate desire, and that's very revealing, because, you know, I thought as a Buddhist monk, you're going to get rid of desire. You know, you're celibate, and you've just got to, and you should be satisfied with the four requisites, and you've got to get rid of these desires. You've got to get rid of sexual desire. You've got to get rid of desire for sense pleasures, and then on the sensual level, you know, one conceived desire only through the senses, sense gamadana, or sensual desire. But then they have bhavadana and vipavadana, so they have three categories of desire. And the second category is bhava dhanha, desire for becoming, getting something you don't want. I mean, getting something that you want. You imagine enlightenment, you want it. You imagine nibbana, you want it. You imagine heaven, then you want it. Because you don't have, now that's suffering, to want something. Some high-minded thing, it isn't like a low desire, but it's maybe an aspiration or wish for something better than what you have is like this. So that's awareness. You're aware of wanting something that you imagine that's better than the way you see yourself in the present. And then vipava dhanha, desire to get rid of desire. Desire to get rid of anger, jealousy, fear. You know, these are like vipava dhanha. So, you know, these are to be investigated. Like you could see how vipava dhanha, desire to get rid of things. There's a monk wanting to get rid of anger, sexual desire in his celibate life, wanting to get rid of sexual desire, wanting to get rid of anger and fear, wanting to get rid of frustration, because it was very frustrating at first. You know, being in a very strict Thai monastery whose language, you know, I didn't understand anything that was going on most of the time. And so there's a lot of bhava dhanha, vipava dhanha going on in my mind. But it was the... And then the food, the way Lungpa Cha delivered the food, there was a lot of aversion. He mixed everything together. So getting used to Northeast Thai food all mixed together in a bowl, you know, it was really unpalatable at first. And wanting to get rid of your desire, your aversion to it, you know, you think, this is food offered by the lay people, you know, not for beauty, not for personal adornment or anything, but just for, not for pleasure, not for excitement. And you look at this food and you think, there's no pleasure, excitement. But the monastic life can be idolized, you know, into the perfect bhikkhu is like this, the perfect samana. But then the Four Noble Truths are not about ideals, they're about the way things are. So you can use, you know, like aversion to the food. You can see the form of not wanting it is suffering. The desire to get better food, more delicious food, is like this. So you're mindful, you're aware of your desire. You know, you're not trying to fight them and convince yourself you're content with something you don't like, but you're observing. You're the witness of discontentment or aversion is like this. And you have the insight into letting go of that. Because the suffering is through attachment to sankharas. Blind, ignorant attachment to habits, to desires without any mindfulness or understanding beyond it. So that's why in the First Noble Truth it's to understand suffering. To understand something, you have to accept it. You know, if you're always trying to resist it, blame it on somebody else, get rid of it, you'll never understand dukkha. You'll never have any insight into the noble truth of suffering. And then the second noble truth, desire, is this is a desire realm. Your body is a desire form. That what we see, hear, smell, taste, touch, you know, we like this. We desire to look at beautiful sights, not ugly ones. Fragrant odors, not smelly ones. We want beautiful sounds, not cacophonous ones and so forth. You know, we want desires for the best and for the pleasure of the senses give us a lot of pleasure. But when we, you know, but life itself presents us with things we don't, that are ugly, that are cacophonous, noisy, unpleasant sounds, or smelly, stinky. We feel heat or cold, the bite of mosquitoes, with these sensitive forms. There's a desire realm that these forms are desire forms. But are you desire? Is that your true nature? You know, you can assume that your nature is a desire, but your true nature is awareness. You know, that's what doesn't change, which isn't born and dies, doesn't come and go. So that's why this emphasis on mindfulness, rather than on trying to perfect a monastery so it pleases everybody, you know, we could have a sensual monastery where the food is absolutely delicious and everybody is beautiful. And I mean, that's an ideal, and that'll never happen. Because even then, if one could create such a monastery, we'd still suffer, because we hadn't really come to the cause of suffering. We just kind of blinded ourselves by trying to create the illusion of happiness or beauty. Where if you follow the paradigm of the Noble Truth, they take you to the cause, to the cessation of suffering. So awareness. You know, even with the aging condition of a body, you know, if I attach to it, this is, you know, on a personal level, personality, I don't want to grow old. But the personality is a condition that comes and goes and changes. But awareness doesn't. So one sees the body in terms of suffering. It is what it is, so it's supposed to get old. This is natural. This is what it's supposed to do. It's doing what bodies are supposed to do. They were born, they grow up, get old, they get sick, they get weak, they die. So we don't create suffering around them when we understand it, when we understand suffering. Whatever you attach to, like idealism, you know, people suffer a lot because they're very idealistic. And about themselves, about the society, about their family. So, you know, they're always complaining and they're suffering because in family life, you know, nobody's going to just be perfect for you, for what you desire and perceive and idealize. We each are individual conditions that are karmic formations that are awakening to reality. So this is, you know, this is when the reality of sankharas is they're imperfect, they're not satisfactory, so they're suffering. It's not a put down. And, you know, sometimes the word suffering sounds like everything's suffering, it's just all miserable. And we can, you know, convince ourselves of that when we're depressed. You know, you get depressed and everything looks horrible. But that's suffering that you create through not understanding suffering. So the kind of genius of the Buddha was to take something so common and nobody wants it, and then make us look at it, put, you know, call it a noble truth. And I used to question, what's noble and true about suffering? I don't want it. You know, universal love is noble and true. But that's what I want. But the suffering, I don't want it. And then, but then because the Buddha put it in this, you know, isn't pointing to conscious, to universal love as a belief system, you're starting from where you're at in the here and now with something ordinary like loneliness or fear or guilt, remorse, desire for something you don't have, desire to get rid of things you have you don't like. And they're to be investigated. And that's what bhavana really means, is investigating. So it's like you're giving the right to investigate reality here at Nanachan. You know, the whole point of this tradition is not to become a monk or a nun and get enlightened, but it's a form, a useful form, traditional form, that encourages investigation of reality.